Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast from Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, join us for a powerful conversation reflecting on the 40th anniversary of the 1984 to 1985 miners' strike, one of the most pivotal events in Britain's industrial and political history. Recorded live at the 2025 festival, the panel examined how media narratives shaped public perception and how ideas of masculinity, solidarity, and sacrifice were forged and fractured in the fight for survival.
Thank you, everybody. My name's Samia, and I'd like to welcome you to this event today, which looks at 40 years on, the lasting legacy of the miners' strike. I'm really thrilled to introduce our speakers today. We have Emily Weber. Emily completed a PhD at the University of Reading, which actually I went to too, and the University of Exeter. And her research focused on masculinity in the British mining industry from nationalisation in 1947 to pit closures at the end of the 20th century. She was born in South Yorkshire. I was born in West Yorkshire. There you go. And Emily has spoken to over 100 former miners over the last 5 years, collecting their memories of the industry and travelling to their communities. She was previously the research manager at the Imperial War Museum and contributed to several public-facing publications. And she'll be speaking about her book, Mining Men, Britain's Last Kings of the Coalface. So welcome, Emily. Thank you. And I'd also like to welcome Craig Oldham. So Craig Oldham is one of the most influential designers. That was a build-up.
Where was my drum roll?
One of the most influential designers working in the UK, and he's written books on a range of topics, including education, culture, and politics. He's the concept and series editor of Epiphany Editions, the first of which, They Live, A Visual and Cultural Awakening, was published in January 2019. And more recently, The Shining, A Visual and Cultural Haunting. He's also Rough Trade Books creative director. And in his bio, he's written, he's obviously an all-round good guy.
I'll caveat this when you're
gonna,
I didn't write that. That was Nina,
my
publisher.
That's going to be tested. And Craig has written, In Loving Memory of Work, A Visual Record of the UK Miners' Strike, 1984 to 85. Now, believe it or not, I remember the miners' strike. And it has really kind of, you know, really sort of been a real kind of transformative period in sort of British history. I'd like to begin by asking Emily, what inspired you to focus on this era? What inspired your research?
So as you mentioned, I was born in South Yorkshire in the immediate aftermath of the strike. And I guess, although I'm not from a mining family myself, we had friends in the industry and, you know, obviously the pits were all around where I grew up. And I think I saw firsthand the rapid deindustrialization that was happening across Yorkshire at that time. And obviously the steelworks closing down. And as a child, I didn't really understand what was going on. I knew lots of people were very sad and I couldn't quite fathom what it all meant. And so when I came to looking at what I was going to do for my PhD, I decided that I would look at the miners' strike. But then as I started to do that, I realized I could never hope to understand what was at stake during the strike for miners and their communities and their families without going much further back to really think about what the industry had meant in their lives and, you know, in their families' lives. And so that's why the PhD took me much further back.
And the PhD evolved into a book.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that. I mean, after a three-year PhD, you went sort of tired of the topic.
No, I think I was really conscious that I had all these incredible life stories. And in the way in which the PhD was written, obviously it was very academic and I was kind of dotting in and out of people's lives. And I wanted to showcase men's lives in kind of their entirety, in each chapter focused on a different man's experience of the industry. But also I wanted to celebrate the industry. I didn't want to focus on the negative aspects or pit closures or the strike. I really wanted to focus on some of the good times as well and tell the full story through these men's journeys from, you know, the schoolyard through the pit and then after pit closures. So yeah, that's where the book took me.
Tell us a little bit more about the good times. I mean, that's an interesting angle, isn't it? Because we think of this period as quite a very difficult moment.
Yeah.
For these communities. What were the good times?
So I think the strike was a very difficult experience. At the same time, I think it brought a lot of people together in communities. But, you know, this was all part of the camaraderie underground was like nothing else. And that was the single thing that everybody missed coming out of the pit after pit closures. People would say they missed the pit and they didn't miss the dark conditions and the danger and, you know, the dusty air. They missed the people. They missed those strong, close bonds. And so that was something I really wanted to bring out in the book to say, look, there was something really special here that we've lost, actually. And actually, many of the men I spoke to, they never found that again after leaving the pit. In other workplaces, it just didn't exist. So, yeah.
My dad said the same thing. My dad, my granddad, my great-granddad, and so on and so forth into oblivion. You know, we're all coal miners. My dad would always say, like, well, I'd go down pit tomorrow if they were back open. He was so fond of it.
That's how integral it was to his sense of self.
Mm. Yeah, I think he really formed his whole identity around being a miner, this kind of, you know, they were the aristocrats of the working classes, you know, it was really skilled, dangerous work, but it had, because literally if you didn't look after the person at the side of you and that person at that side he didn't look after you, then we are talking life and death. So it did build a unique bond amongst these people, and it was funny by all accounts. Like, all they have is story after story after story. I mean, you could regale you for days, my dad, you know.
Tell us a little, if you wouldn't mind sort of expanding a little bit on sort of the reasons for writing your book. I mean, obviously you come from a mining
family.
Well,
I mean, my book wasn't about the good times at all. My book was solely about the strike. I mean, I'm kind of a charlatan here. You know, I'm not a writer, I'm a designer, and I was really interested in the visual culture of my community that I grew up in. But saying that, everything you said was my experience as well, like growing up in a post-industrial kind of aftermath, this wake kind of, you know, that thing that I think all kids have it, like they think their upbringing is like everyone else's upbringing, that kind of world ends there thing when you're growing up. I just thought everybody's dad had a battered denim jacket with badges all over it, and everybody's granddad threw slipper at telly when Thatcher were on. And, you know, I just thought that was normal life. And I thought everybody had left-leaning red kind of politics, called everybody comrade, etc., so on and so forth. I just thought that was it. And then it wasn't until you kind of grow up and you go to school and you learn more about your context in this and then Barnsley's context in that, and then kind of zoom out, that you realise, even though, you know, we were kind of a generation after that, and we have our own story and our own version of it, my family, my community was a big thing. Like, so many other people had a kind of a very close, similar experience to me. And that actually has a power. Mm. And all this stuff, because the strike was, you know, lost in inverted commas, the stuff that was produced from that, from a creative point of view, that I saw around that had value to me, like, you know, we think about protests now and we think about dissent, and we usually just think about placards and a kind of a very raw, crude anger. But actually, there's a lot of other stuff that was made, and the strike had it all. They had people made, they made films, you know, they stood up in front of people that they'd never stood up for, you know, in front of before, and they sang songs and they wrote poems and they wrote stories. And yes, they made placards and banners and bedsheets and badges. And it was a creative explosion in a kind of post-punk Britain. And I was really interested in that because those stories were just absolutely willfully ignored by the ruling classes and the middle classes and people like the museum over there and fucking V&A and all these, you know, cultural bourgeoisie just ignored it because they didn't think it had any value. But I think that does have value, and that's what my book was about.
And as a designer, I thought it was very interesting that you focused on this kind of visual storytelling. Can you tell us a little bit about what you could bring to the sort of the narrative of the miners' strike that was missing? I mean, you mentioned, you know, the museums negated a lot of these, you know, symbols of the miners' strike.
What I think about it really is, and I you know, I don't want to disappear too far up one's own behind here, but it's like what I see in what happened during the miners' strike is when you're facing an unbelievable hardship, you know, 12 months solid, no money in your household whatsoever, minimal support, kind of scraped together and a community ignored and kind of left to fend for itself. Incredible hardships. People responded to that with creativity and a kind of stoic creativity. And they had something to say and they took to a creativity to express that and get it out of themselves and externalize what they were feeling and come together and find out ways in which they can fight their fight and stand up for their community and talk about their pain and talk about their frustrations and talk about their politics. But they did it in such a creative way that I see in that. And you see the miners doing it. You see the women's movement in particular doing it, borrowing from, you know, women's movements of the past and saying, well, that really worked for them. Let's try that. And then they went off and did their own kind of version of it. And there was this building of stuff. And I think that's how is that, particularly in the volatile world we live in now, how useful it would be to see these things and say, they dealt with a really hard time now. We're facing a hard time now. Maybe there's some strategies to employ there creatively. Mm-hmm. And again, you look at the women's movement, it's like they created social structures that didn't depend on wages and they fed people, clothed people, gave people judicial advice, benefits advice, sent kids on holiday, got kids Christmas presents, you name it, with no money. I mean, how valuable would a model like that be today?
Absolutely, absolutely.
So that was that was the value I saw that people were ignoring.
Amazing.
People, you know.
Now, we've talked so far about sort of the ways in which these communities were decimated and absolutely, you know, kind of attacked. And Emily, you focus a little bit on the concept of masculinity.
Yeah.
And really sort of, I mean, you alluded to it as well, Craig, you know, this idea of sort of, you know, the tradition of mining, you know, kind of being intergenerational, being, you know, a real focus of pride for families. Mm. And when the pits were being closed down and, you know, people were facing redundancy, can you tell us a little bit about what that did to the sense of self for a lot of these men and how it tied into sort of ideas of masculinity?
I think it was incredibly challenging for them. I think they had to learn who they were outside of the pit and something that they'd, you know, seen modelled by their forefathers. I think one particular chap, John, I found his story incredibly compelling. He'd been part of the Mines Rescue Service. And they were basically the people when an accident happened, they went underground, risked their lives to get people out. And he was incredibly proud of his role in the mines rescue. And when he came out, you know, he ended up working in a factory and he kind of had a bit of a breakdown where he was like, I don't know who I am anymore. And he'd had a lot of very difficult circumstances that had happened to him, particularly during the strike. But he eventually retrained as a counsellor. And what he learned, and he put it beautifully, is that he could save people with his mind instead of his body. And so he'd found a really great way of adapting the gift that he had in terms of rescuing people for a kind of post-pit society, as it were. Not everybody had that kind of epiphany where they were like, you know, I can become this different person. Some people followed the industry overseas. I think what's interesting, though, is it's not just that generation. It's their sons and their grandchildren who were kind of left without this traditional pathway of this is what you do to become a man and this, you know, and the opportunities. I mean, at its peak, the coal board, the apprenticeship program was really great and it had good salary, good training, and there was no equivalent to replace it in these communities. And so I was speaking to another set of miners in Cotgrave in Nottinghamshire, and they were really struggling with antisocial behaviour. And there was this kind of understanding that it was outsiders who were the people responsible for the antisocial behaviour that was taking place. And they'd had arson attacks on the church and the community centre. And these chaps who were trustees of the community centre now, they went and looked at who the people were doing it. And they found that they were the sons and the grandsons of the big hitters underground. So the people who were earning the top wages. And their thoughts on it that they shared with me is that these lads were coming home and looking at their dad and going, you know, you had the status, you had the job, you've got the long service certificate, what's for me? Where do I go? Where's my plan? And so I think it did have like intergenerational consequences moving forward in terms of pathways to a kind of adult masculinity.
I mean, Craig, also you mentioned this, you know, quote unquote defeat that the miners' strike sort of epitomized. Was that also a defeat of masculinity? Was that a real defeat of, you know, the kind of the patriarchal order, that if there was a patriarchal order in which a lot of these communities existed and that was perpetuated?
I mean, there absolutely was a patriarchy, yeah. I mean, you can't deny that. But I mean, I think it's all very familiar, that kind of patriarchal model was, you know,
I mean, it was universal across
It wasn't just mining communities.
Yeah.
It was a societal-wide thing. Yeah. But that idea that dad goes to work, he earns the money, mum stays at home, looks after the family, does the cleaning, buys the shopping, does the cooking. As one Women Against Pit Closures activist told me, she said she felt like a clockwork doll in that kind of structure. And then suddenly that structure was broken because there was no longer an income coming in and the man had nothing to do but pick it. And I think that the talk, I feel sort of, I don't feel conflicted about this. I feel proud, actually, that what the women did, and I'm much more identify with the women's movement and what that did as a kind of consequence of the strike as a positive, than focusing on the kind of the negatives of what it left us in the wake of masculinity. You know, like one of the consequences of the strike was that my mum and dad got divorced because of the women's movement. You know, my dad was like, and then my dad retrained and he went into the NHS. Suddenly he was like, right, you can go back to that. And my mum was like, fuck off. You know, I'm affectionately known in Barnsley as a strike Ben, because I was the last ditch attempt at saving that marriage during the strike. You know, dad was off work. They had no else better to do but me. And that fell apart. But as a result of that, I didn't feel like I was without a male role model. I didn't feel like I had no male energy or a masculine kind of archetype to follow. I felt like I became a man because I was raised by really strong women. Wow. Like, my mum was incredible. My nan was incredible. And to be honest, like, this is a kind of a joke of it, but I do think there's an element of truth. And I certainly, from my own lived experience, saw this idea that the patriarchy was there. I almost feel sometimes it was there because the women made the men do it. You know, like, my nan was like an absolute warrior woman. Like, she would do whatever she wanted. Like, she'd go out Saturday night, my granddad would look after us at home. You know, she'd come home drunk, want some chips, my granddad would make her some chips. You know, that kind of idea, like, yeah, you wear the trousers because I tell you to wear the trousers. Yeah. All the women in my family were like that.
But I think
it was great.
I would agree. I think there's kind of this misconception that the women in mining communities were like kind of doormats, and they certainly weren't. And historically they weren't. You can go right back to 1926. They were doing movements then. They were powerful women, and they were like the backbone of these communities. And the men went off to work. And so I think seeing it as a kind of a huge moment, yes, the miners' strike gave them the opportunity to kind of get more involved and be more political. I think they were political people often anyway. I think this was just an opportunity for them, you know, to come to the fore.
And I think it is, it makes it easy to sort of focus in and look at like what was the effect and the kind of consequences on the male or on masculinity as a result of this. But actually, I think you've also got to look at it regardless of any form of sexual identity. Like, removing work from people is like removing their dignity.
Yeah.
No matter what you do, no matter who you are, no matter how old you are. And that's what happened in these communities. They were denied the opportunity to work, to earn a living, to raise a family themselves, or to do whatever they wanted. They had to have the kind of relative autonomy to live their own life was removed from them with no alternative. Mm-hmm. That was it. There's your year's redundancy. Off you go. You're on your own. That was the real impact on masculinity, on the women's movement, on communities, on that kind of collective spirit that we all shared in those communities and in that kind of labour-leaning politic. That's the real thing.
That's really interesting you should bring that up, because this idea of these communities losing their sort of purpose, and as you said, losing their sense of dignity. Do you think that this has been one of the ingredients which has kind of fed into possibly a kind of a more general crisis of identity that you experience in a lot of sort of working class communities that was sort of so much structured on this idea of like work as dignity and sort of, you know, as identity? And I mean, you mentioned that, you know, a lot of the communities were from Labour voting, left-leaning backgrounds. And what we're seeing now is this sort of, you know, this kind of populism that's emerging in those communities. Do you think the miners' strike almost, you know, sowed the seeds for this sort of disillusionment?
I think the seeds were sown before the miners' strike. I'm not sure if it came up in your kind of research and in speaking to them, but you could. Thatcher wasn't the only one that got a slipper thrown at her. Kinnock got one as well, because a lot of the miners felt betrayed by Labour during that dispute. And I think what happened was, I think there's been a kind of slow kind of erosion of that, you know, the Labour movement among those communities, because essentially it was founded by the coal miners and sort of those working class communities, and then they've kind of, as that has become a bigger thing and other things have joined it and the politics have got involved, I'm speaking very generally here obviously, but like, it feels to me like there's been an erosion happen where they've just been betrayed at every kind of crucial point. And even when Labour then got back into power in 97, the trade union movement was the first thing that Blair attacked and eroded again, and he was just kind of Thatcher diet, and they just got betrayed all the time. And I don't think it's necessarily that they've gone, in my personal view, I don't think it's necessarily that these people have gone, right, that dickhead there's got the answers. I actually think it's just created a vacuum, and when those vacuums get bigger and bigger and bigger, it becomes quite easier for these things, with a bit of dog whistling, to come in, say the right things, make the right noises, and that thing can happen. I don't know if that echoes how you feel. Or
in the interviews that I did, there was a big sense that Labour wasn't what it used to be. A lot of the miners referred to themselves as blue Labour, so a more traditional, perhaps, Labour voter. But I mean, if you look at the communities, and you've been communities that I've went to, you can still feel the loss of the strike. And this is now like 40 years on. And I met with a local vicar in Dinnington, and she said she'd only just moved there. And she said, I feel it around every corner, the pit closures, I still feel it. And so she's somebody who just moved into the area, and she could feel this kind of weight because there was nothing to replace it.
Yeah.
And there's just been absolutely inadequate investment in these communities, and so many promises of leveling up that just haven't been realized. And so people feel betrayed, and I think they feel betrayed across the board by both sets of politicians. So at this point, perhaps, they are looking to other solutions, but I think understandably, because they feel completely ignored.
I mean, I think this, you know, you're absolutely right. This lack of a diversity in, you know, or alternative options for these communities in terms of industry, I think that was crucial, because the entire communities were built on, you know, mining and going into the mines, and that was how you earned your bread and butter, and there was no investment in any other infrastructure. Now, you spoke about betrayal, both of you spoke about betrayal quite a lot.
Bitter much?
So as you were both sort of, you know, conducting your research, writing your publications, what was the response like? Were people very willing to speak to you? Was there a sense of suspicion or a sort of, leave us alone? How did you win people's trust?
So I think the natural assumption at the start of most of my interviews was that I was a massive Tory, because I sound like this now, because I've lived in Norwich for quite a while. And so my Yorkshire accent's pretty much completely disappeared at this point. So I had to do a bit of winning them round and kind of offering bits of myself that they trusted me. I think weirdly, one of the weird advantages of what happened during my interview process is my interviews got removed from kind of in a room and taken online because of the pandemic. And so for the first time, you know, normally I turn up to people's houses with an audio recorder and off we go. But they were kind of getting an insight into my life in the background over Zoom, so they could see like my messy kitchen and my kids' artworks all over the fridge. But I think it made me a bit more human and a bit more normal and less of kind of an academic who's kind of in an ivory tower somewhere. So I think that helped a lot. And then just using kind of personal connections where I had them. But yeah, I think there was trust required, and I don't blame them for that, because they've been stitched up a lot. and by, you know, broadcasters and everything. Like, it's a long history of that. So, yeah.
And Craig, this is your family. This is your community. I mean, what, you know, were you made to feel like a sort of, you know, an informant, were people very willing to open up?
It was very similar, really, to what's just been said by Emily. Like, my experience of wanting to speak to a lot of people involved in the strike, from, you know, the kind of the names that you would say as the players, as you would say, you know, the Scargills and Mr. Scargill, but down to all the miners, particularly ones that might have gone through some of the more, you know, if you can get more heinous than the strike itself, like Orgreave and things like that, were very, very sensitive, cautious, protective, all of which was completely understandable. But my secret weapon was my dad, you know, took him with me. not only because he'd be, you know, we'd be in Barnsley and we'd knock on somebody's door and I'd only spoke to these people over the phone maybe or whatever, and then my dad would be like, hey, I used to work with you at Woolley. And instantly disarmed, and my dad could open up a conversation like no one else because he'd just talk about working, and these miners would then have that kind of conversation with my dad, and then I'd just sort of lob a question in, or, and it just watched the whole thing unfold, and it was beautiful, really. It was beautiful. But it wasn't just the validity that my dad was a coal miner, but my dad was arrested at Orgreave as well. And my family went through, he was one of the 95 miners arrested on the day, and we went through all of that. I didn't know any of that until I started doing this book in 2014. No one told me that my dad was arrested at Orgreave because it was a big family secret.
Really?
Involving my granddad's shoes, which...
Your granddad's shoes?
Yeah, I have to tell you now.
Yeah, you set that one up.
It's stupid, really, because it kind of undermines the whole thing. So I was trying to give you some gravitas there, and now I'm going to undermine it all with a daft joke. So my dad was at the front of the push at Orgreave, and he was hit. He said he saw a flash and his mate collapsed at the side of him, and they were linking arms to sort of hold the line. My dad's mate had been knocked unconscious and he was bleeding, so my dad went to get him. The police ranks opened, and my dad was pulled through and arrested, and he was charged with riot and unlawful assembly. He was beaten up, he was spat on, he was pissed on by police, denied legal aid, lots of other stuff. And in the book, In Loving Memory Work, by complete and utter chance, we found a picture of my dad being arrested, like behind the lines, and he's literally getting oiked by two, if you know what oiked means, don't you, surely? Getting oiked by two bobbies. And it's like this, it's like a dance that's happening. My dad's in the middle of it, two bobbies either side, lifting it back to chuck him in the back of the van, which is off. Then all the lines, and then there's one policeman with a megaphone, which turns out is the absolute weapon of a man that was involved in Hillsborough, mm-hmm. who orchestrated it all. So my dad, for some reason, it put himself in this beautiful picture of this horrible thing. And I found this and sort of tested him, because I thought, that's my dad. And then my dad was like, that looks like me, but it was like a tiny little... And then I bought a bi resin, zoomed in. I was like, that's definitely my dad. Phoned him up. He described what he was wearing. He was like, oh, yeah, we didn't talk about it because I took your granddad's shoes that day. And he was like, what do you mean? And he's like, your granddad said, don't go to Orgreave. There's going to be loads of trouble. I don't want you to be in any trouble. And I went anyway, and I took his shoes. And he said, all I remember thinking, what you said, I curled my toes right tight to keep my feet. And he was like, if I lose these shoes, I'm going to get my fucking head kicked in when I get home. So he was more scared of my granddad than he was Bobby's at the time. But yeah, as I said, just undermined the whole thing there. But that was real life.
What did your dad think of the book? What did he think of when you first presented it to him, or when he?
I think he was really proud. I think there's that kind of thing of like.
Was he like, when are you going to get a proper job?
a little bit. I've got another story about that with my mum, but like. I think there was a little bit of that, like, oh, my son's interested in what I did kind of thing. You know, that weird little, you know, peacocking pride. But, you know, I think it was just, he saw that I was trying to, because all the funds from the book go to the Orgreave campaign. I think he saw that I was trying to build something bigger than just, oh, our Craig wants to do a book. It was more about, like, that whole way of life. That was a kind of point of entry to... reappraise and get people to look at this as a whole way of life that actually happened. This actually happened. this actually matters. And I think my dad was more proud of that, really. And my mum, that was just like, I've been, because I'm a graphic designer by, that's what I do for a living. No one in my family even knows where a graphic designer is, let alone, they were just like, oh, all right, ah, Craig draws pictures. And I thought, when I did this book and I designed it and I wrote it and I produced it and published it, I thought, this, they're going to know now where a graphic designer is. And my mum just tells everyone I'm an author now. Failed at that.
They were proud in their own ways.
Yeah, yeah. Sure.
Emily, did you get a chance to, send your book to any of your contributors? And what was their response?
It's been really wonderful, actually. So I sent them all a copy of the hardback as soon as it came out. They were first people that got it before it was in shops. But yeah, they've all been. I think it's weird when you're reading your life history in a book, and I think a lot of them referred to it as my project and not like, and I was trying to say it's going to be a real book and it's going to be in Waterstones, hopefully. And they were like, good luck with your project. And so when I think it became a real thing and then it came through the door, they were like, it's a real book. And I was like, yeah, it's a real book. But yeah, I mean, it's been really lovely. And John, one of them, has done a little plaque for the book that's going to be up in the National Coal Mining Museum for England, which is just incredible and just so unexpected. So yeah, I just hope that I've done something to correct a lot of the damage that was done to the idea of who miners were by the press in 1984-85. That was one of my motivations. I was so angry after I was seeing the way they were being portrayed, and I really wanted to tell a very different story and also to represent a really diverse range of men. So yes, you've got your hypermasculine big hitters in there, but you've also got really sensitive chaps. There were loads of different people worked in the pit. And I think that was the other thing that I really wanted to show, because I think quite often there's a stereotype of who the miners were. And so I wanted to offer a very different view on that.
I think both of you were motivated by this idea of bearing witness, right? And kind of contributing to this body of knowledge that exists about this period in history, which has been, as I said, very formative in kind of sort of our understanding of how communities can become fragmented, how they can become sort of lose their sense of belonging. What were the hopes of the people that you interviewed? How did they hope that you would make a difference? Or what?
So I think there was a big awareness that they were the last generation of miners, and so they wanted to record their stories. I think particularly in COVID, a lot of them were very vulnerable. They had underlying lung disease, and so they wanted to make sure that their stories were captured, and all of my audio recordings are going to be deposited at the National Coal Mining Museum, so they will be there for posterity. Because like kids today, and even in some of the mining communities, like in Aylsham down in Kent, they don't know what a lump of coal is. And so the idea that, there was no kind of, here's a story, not just of the strike, but of the whole industry, that they were very pleased to see that it was being kind of celebrated, the good things as well as the strike. We all remember it for the strike, but kind of seeing it for more than that. And there were really beautiful parts of it as well. And I think the other thing I really wanted to do is talk about Orgreave as well. So there's a chapter on Orgreave. And they really, time's up now, we need an inquiry. And so I wanted to try and make the case for that as much as I could in the book as well.
Yeah. I mean, it is scandalous that there hasn't been an inquiry. I mean, that's so shocking.
Yeah. And they've been they've been getting rid of the evidence.
Yeah.
I think that came out last week that they'd got rid of the files.
Yeah.
As soon as Labour put it in their manifesto, now it's time to get rid of these files.
Mm-mm.
So, yeah.
Absolutely. One thing that I thought was quite interesting was, coal has a bit of a bad press now, right? And it was probably relatively soon after the miners' strike that, kind of environmental awareness started to sort of reach new heights. But really, this wasn't about coal, was it? This wasn't about mining. This was about the way in which communities are besieged, are brought to their knees, the ways in which they're humiliated, and the ways in which governments, engineer this kind of like this sort of social experiment and attack the heart of communities. Do you think this, the sort of you know, the environmental aspect has any place in the narrative.
I mean, I get this all the time, like, oh yeah, but coal's a dirty word. It's like, it's called in loving memory of work, not in loving memory of coal.
Yeah.
Because it's about the people, for me. That was their living. And it wasn't even, you know, after the miners' strike, you know, there's a bit of greenwashing that goes on there from the Tory party. I mean, Boris Johnson said it himself. He called Thatcher an environmental pioneer. She shut the pits. It's like, yeah, or try another one, you clown. But that, you know, it pervades, you know, because they say it enough. But before that, you know, the alternative was nuclear power. When that discussion was going on and the CND and all their kind of activism was about the environment, even in the coal industry themselves, a lot of what we kind of became carbon capture technology was being looked at and explored within pits to sort of look at how that could be minimized, changed. And again, because all they were thinking about was how we've got an enormous workforce. What are we going to do with these people eventually? Because you could eradicate the fact in an alternate, we could go off to on a tangent now to an alternate reality where coal doesn't kill our planet. It was still at an end point because we would run out of it. So they were always trying to think of longevity and thinking of terms where, what do we do with all these people and how do we use their skills to benefit everyone else?
Yeah.
And then the Tories came along and they didn't really care about that at all.
Yeah.
So for me, like, that environmental aspect is absolutely valid. It's also like, I don't want to live in a world where we send people underground to fight the earth for a living. I think that's another aspect that gets kind of looked, despite or in spite of all the love and warmth and humour and all that good stuff that did come from it. It was still a pretty horrific job. Yeah. People lost their lives doing that job.
Yeah.
And that's another reason to sort of talk about that. But
I think the ridiculous thing is as well, it was only, I think, end of last year that the coal fire power station, the last one here, shut.
Yeah.
So we've been in
it
4 decades.
Yeah.
So it was a completely ridiculous exercise. Like, we were still using it. And instead of having our own coal, we were like, well, we'll have some from over there. So actually the environmental impact was worse.
Yeah.
Because you're then having to transport it.
Transporting it from, you know, apartheid South Africa at the time, and also dictator-led South American countries.
Exactly.
So,
as you said, I mean, it was all greenwashing.
Yeah.
It was a way to repackage the story and make the miners the villains and, you know, unwilling to sort of accept change. Yeah. And does this come up in any of the interviews that you did with the contributors to your books? Do they speak about, you know, this sort of greenwashing element?
I mean, I think they find it absolutely insane that we carried on importing coal. Mm. And I think there was also something really vindictive about the fact that they saw the pits that their great-grandfathers had dug, concreted and filled in, and to say, you can never get down there again because we're going to allow it to flood and all of this. So that was, you know, they completely removed any opportunity to have access to the coal again, which was awful and very, very vindictive. But I mean, a lot of them talked to me about, in kind of the, I guess it would be the early 1980s and late 1970s, the things that they were doing, the programs they had, the research programs to try and find cleaner uses for coal, as you mentioned. Yeah. So it really was happening. So there was every chance that they would have made something that, you know, didn't require us to burn it, but we'll never know.
We're talking about an incredibly skilled workforce. You know, they were an incredibly skilled workforce, and they could have been put to such an incredible use that. And it's like I look at my kind of dad and my granddad. You know, was no longer with us, but I look at these people who were so resourceful. My granddad he had a kitchen drawer and he'd pull it and it'd like vomit on you. It's just full of crap, you know. Bits of string, matches, keys. You didn't even know what they opened. You know, it's just like, we call it the shite drawer. But my nan had a whinge about something and said, Ron, fix that. And he'd look at this drawer and he'd do that kind of Labrador head turn number, you know, and then he'd look at this problem and he'd solve it.
Mm.
And I used to think, how did he do that?
Yeah.
Who told him that would fix that? And it's this kind of creative inventiveness. And I, as much as I love that and I kind of rejoice in it, it's all gone. It died with him.
Yeah.
And there was no legacy of that to pass it on to. There was no retraining. There was no exchange. There was no sharing of all that knowledge and skill and imagination. It's not just practical. Like, I was taught this from the, this is in the manual. You learn that. There was a, an unbelievable resourcefulness, which again, born out in the book that I did, came out in creativity, in fight for something. But that was there in their every single day workflows. And I think it's such a loss.
It's such a loss, and it's not talked about, because when people talk about, you know, the miners' strike, they talk about these tedious, dangerous, routine jobs. They don't talk about the sort of, you know, as you said, the sort of the skill that's required, the imagination, the creativity of these workers, and how they could have been put to such great use, as you said. It's really, yeah, it's such a, I mean, the demonization of these communities and these men has been shocking. I think at this stage I might take some,
we've got
15 minutes, just over 15 minutes left. Do I have any questions? Put my glasses on so I can see. Do I have any questions?
Oh, please, come on. Gorilla. There we go. Will we be selling and signing copies of our book? Yes, we will. In the tent.
If it's
still there and not blown away. Yeah, I was outside earlier and it was getting ready for takeoff.
Yeah, there will be. The gentleman.
Oh, it's just a mic coming to you.
Yeah, you talk about betrayal. It seems to me that disabled people are now being betrayed by the Labour leadership. And I remember Sun headlines and News of the World headlines during the miners' strike, and during Hillsborough as well. And now it looks as though the Murdoch media is trying to demonise disabled people as well.
Very true.
Absolutely. I mean, there's this rhetoric of the left behind, right? And this, you know, it's often the marginalised, the most vulnerable in our communities.
It's whoever the right wing press decides to go after next and to blame the world's problems on. Yeah.
I think to your point, like, the miners' strike really did bring forth, even though you didn't really have to look hard if you wanted to in disputes before that or even anything before that, but it's a very good case study of like how the state can utilise what it has at its disposal, the police force, the judicial system and the media. Like, I think my numbers might be wrong here, but definitely check it out if you want to have a fight with me. Like, I think there were 13 national newspapers at the time during the strike. I think one or two of those, you know, you might say The Guardian and whatever else, The Mirror, there were some of them were still very trade union led, but a lot of the ones that were in Thatcher's pocket, I think 10 editors were knighted within a year of the strike finishing. So that to me tells you.
I mean, that machinery. You know,
the lizards. It is a machine, yeah. Then they deployed everything they could.
Yeah.
You know, there's a really famous cover of The Sun that was retracted by print workers because they refused to run it. And basically, there was a ransom out on any photographer that could catch a Scargill with his hand in the air, making it look like he was doing a Nazi salute. They would pay high money for that. And because he used to lead his march, he'd get to the front and he'd go like that and tell everyone to move. And all these little spiders with the cameras a bit.
Wow.
And the print workers refused to use it. You can find that online. And that was just one day of 365 plus days where they were at them. Grim.
We had a gentleman here.
What could we have done differently? I mean, mining is an extractive industry. We've got a serious problem with too much CO2 in the atmosphere now. Mrs. Thatcher, for all her faults, actually saw that, but she had no idea of creating anything to replace it. But how could we have large numbers of high-skilled jobs, high-wage jobs that replaced coal mining?
But they had done that previously. So there were actually more pits closed pre the strike than there were post the strike. But the point was they did it better. They did it more gradually. And they did try and bring more training and more jobs in. The point that what Thatcher did, she wanted to give them a kicking. So she closed them en masse, didn't put the infrastructure in place for retraining. And so it was decimated in one foul swoop. And so you had so many people trying to get the jobs that were available across the area, all competing over maybe 10, 20 jobs. You've got hundreds of people. It could have been done so much better. Pit closures could have been managed so much better over a much longer period of time. And people could have maintained their sense of dignity and their ability to work. I think any argument that she did it for environmental reasons is erroneous, I'm afraid. So, yeah. Sorry.
I don't know if you want to add anything to that, Craig.
Other than ditto, And yeah, I mean, if this, I mean, it just doesn't stand up. Like, the power hungry kind of make Britain the best in the world, Thatcher. Like, if that was her plan, what did she do with it? Fuck all. She did nothing. She didn't put those people to work or enslave them somewhere else. She did nothing. She just wanted to put all the unions away to bed. I mean, through sheer embarrassment of her career, really.
I mean, you really could argue it was ideological. It was ideological, and it was targeting a community that weren't her electorates, and she knew she would be able to get away with it.
And they took, I mean, the earlier strike, you know, was a 3-day week, and that government was a Tory government, and, you know, who rules Britain, and it wasn't them at that point. So she'd learned from that, and she had her ducks in order with things like the Ridley plan. So she knew how she was going to win, and tested the waters in 1981, and it wasn't the right time. So there was a plan, like, you know, yeah.
I hope that answers your question. We have a gentleman here with a question.
Thank you. I should say that at that time of the strike, I was actually I was training medics, and I used to go and join in solidarity with the strikes. But I want to raise some, you know, when you compare that time there and before to the time now and where we are now, and quite clearly we're in the sort of the aftermath of that, or something that was going on, because you mentioned this masculinity and femininity, or maternity, you use that word, is that and I must admit that being raised in those times, this idea of masculinity was actually belonging. And also the idea of maternity, you talked about, you know, today was, you know, the maternity was actually very much about family, you know, and community, getting, and it's, you know, and in a way today, when you think about, oh, we were going to get coal cheaply, you know, we're so happy, we in England, so happy to go to the superstores, we take no note of where the food that's being grown, what the people are being paid. You know, we get it with all our clothes that we wear, we don't make them. And we've got this idea that the most important thing in life is money. It's not family, it's not community, and it's not work. So we need to raise those three profiles very strongly, because without those, we have no meaning, and English culture will go nowhere. That's just a thought.
These are our neoliberal times.
Thatcher's Britain.
Quite not, yeah.
It. You
know, it's
the legacy of Thatcher.
A narco-socialist.
Yeah. You know, you're living in the utopia of Thatcher, really. Crumbling now it is, but nonetheless. But, you know, what you said there really does resonate with me. Like, I have absolutely, you know, in many ways, like, I've absolutely no right to sort of ask to belong to this kind of tradition, of which, you know, I've only ever been down a pit in a museum because they were closed by the time I'd grown up. And so in many ways, you could say I long for something that I never experienced. But my very core of my identity, I can instantly track it back to those principles of that community that self-generated and created things like the NHS and welfare and all these kinds of political leanings and principles that I've been raised on come from that. And I think that's the name I give to this loss that I feel. And I do feel like when I go through this, I did another kind of similar panel like this last month, and we had an artist who, Sally Barton's her name, and her work is about Orgreave, and she's a generation after me. And she still feels the same way I do, whereas I'm still a bit, you know, kind of venomous about it all. Sally's like seeing more of the good and using that to try and show people and bring that back. But it's still there, and it is a kind of a generational trauma, really. It's a generational loss or a longing to be a collective again, to look after each other, to have a sense of community and family, and know that actually, in a weird, weird, weird way, that if something might not go right for you or goes wrong for you, there's always someone else that might just be able to just keep you up a little bit and prop you up. And I think so many of us feel that if we wobble off, or worse, if we fall now, there's no one there for us. And that's incredibly painful.
The individualistic society that Thatcher really remade Britain in the shape of.
Thank you for saying that.
Yeah, I think I would completely agree. And I think that it was kind of nice, again, in the pandemic, the miners that I was speaking to were falling into familiar patterns in terms of looking out for the people in their community. So they knew people who were vulnerable and they were going around and, you know, dropping off groceries or, you know, asking if they needed to pick up medication or whatever. And it was like watching it again to be like, when there's a crisis, and granted they're fragmented now, but those bonds still exist with the surviving miners amongst them. But it's a huge loss. And, you know, I think I obviously came not from a mining family. I came from a very proud working class family. But I think I talk in the book how writing it and learning from all these different experiences, I feel like it gave so much to me. And it was like, these are the principles that actually are important in life. It was like a reminder, learning from all these different men, you know, 100 different men. And at the end of it, they would pass on their life message. It got to be this weird little routine where they'd be like, this is something for you to think about. And it was all kind of about the importance of looking after each other. And that's what Camaraderie Underground was all about. So I think if we can take anything from the industry, we should take that.
I think solidarities and building on solidarities and how these movements really are replicated across sort of sites of oppression. I think this is the big learning that we take from the miners' strike and its aftermath. Do I have any more questions? Oh,
yeah. I was going to ask, when you were talking about all of the shit that went down at the protest, I think the shoes really just stood out to everyone because in all of the insanity that was going on, it's such a human thing to worry about.
Yeah.
Were there any things in your books, just like little things while you were writing, that stood out to you in that human detail way of everything's going to shit, but something tiny is just catches in your brain?
I've got loads, but you go.
I guess for me, there was a thing about like kind of superstition and having the right socks on and having the right boots. And if somebody had moved something, you know, and so then it would be part of this horrific, maybe rueful that they'd be talking about. And they'd turn and they'd be like, it was because of the socks. Like that was the entire thing. But I think for me, that really took it to kind of a more human level where they're trying to rationalize something awful that's happened. Dark humor was incredible underground and it was very blue at times, but there was also a really morbid side to the dark humor. One guy had to go and collect a leg that had been torn off somebody underground, and he was walking with it and he just felt absolutely horrific about what had happened. But he was carrying this leg with a boot on it in a paper bag and he didn't know what to do. So he just went, does anybody want to buy a boot? And it is just stuff like that. And it was how they made it okay. But things like that, yeah, they were very human responses.
I just think, like, I mean, awful things can make you laugh, yeah, can't they? So, yeah. And they had, like we've said, you know, an awfully hard job. Yeah. So that was very much part of the coping mechanism. Yeah,
coping.
The response, you know. But, I mean, I'll just give you two quick ones. But there was one from the strike that was regaled to me that just never fails to make me laugh. During the strike, towards the sort of end of it, the kind of, you know, post-Christmas, January, February, when it was kind of, in hindsight, winding down, the NCB made it a sackable offence to call anyone a scab. And as a result, the miners, in their eternal creativity, used to say sausage, chips and beans to people. And so you'd hear the most venomous cry over the village pub of sausage, chips and beans, you know, at someone if they'd crossed the picket line. And there was this one story of that happening where the guy who was actually, he told me this story and he was like, I was like on my last warning at work. He was like, and then when a scab came in the pub and I thought, I can't say because I'm going to get done. So he sort of went to his mate, he's like, he's there, shout it. And he forgot all the way. So he's just like, sausage, fried egg and mashed potatoes. So he's just shouting food at him. But I love all that because it does humanise it, yeah. Whatever. I know there's a whole underpinning story there. And the other one was my dad. Like, he told me the story of being in the pit and he was on the belt and all the coal was coming up and there was a lever that he had to pull to make sure the thing kicked up the right way. And he said it got stuck and all this coal was tipping on him. and he was really shitting himself and he was terrified. And it got to a point where he couldn't move. He said he really had a moment. I said he'd stopped crying. He just thought, this is it. I'm done. I'm going to die. And then he heard a massive crank and one of his mates had passed him, pulled the lever, stopped it all. He was like, they're getting up, mate. The fucking shift's done. And then he put him on belt and sent him up, which they weren't allowed to do, but he did it anyway. So yeah, there's lots. The book, because yeah, they're all there. Like,
I think
amazing.
It's those human stories. It's the humanizing of these, you know, these times from the past, which are so embedded in our kind of national sort of history and our national memory. We've almost run out of time now. I'm sorry to anyone else who had a question, but please do go to the tent and buy the books. They're phenomenal. And I think they really add this kind of richness and sort of wealth of understanding to this much publicized period in British history, which actually, when you think about it, is so much more kind of, it has so many more layers. So thank you, Emily, and thank you, Craig, and thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast with Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others, and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival, Friday the 3rd to Sunday the 12th of July, 2026.